Joyce, welcome. For Farhan, this is our Web3 1:1 talk show. As you guys are from DeFi at large, and then stable coins, right? Can you break it down for the community over here listening to us, what actually DeFi means in a very simple terms?
I love that question. It is indeed a very broad one. So I would say, and that is my own interpretation. I'll leave it to Farhan to see, you know, if there are more you would like to add. So for me, that it is, this whole space is decentralized finance. And fundamentally, it is trying to break away from what we have been used to, meaning a centralized authority or a centralized organization, a company that manages how our money goes. And that really comes down to two things. One is where the money is being stored and what type of services would you actually get. And to me, decentralized finance are trying to do both, right? So one, you can become non-custodial. You can use your non-custodial wallet, so your keys, your money, and then you don't have to rely on a third party like a bank to really put your money, set it aside. And then you don't have to run the risk of not being able to access your money when you need them for any reasons. And then the second part is on how exactly are the services given to you, you know, determined? Why would you have the access to, you know, yield farming in stable coins? Why can you take out a collateral against, you know, to borrow against it? I think a lot of these decisions in a traditional finance side has been determined by, again, the bank or the ecosystem within it to say, should you as an individual get credit card? That's what I was doing before. Or should you get a mortgage? Should you get a car loan? Those are a lot of the access to different types of services that is being determined by, again, a more centralized figure. And that might be a bank or that might be a credit bureau. So I think like decentralized finance to me is to break away from all those and making sure that you as an individual have access to your funds through a non-custodial wallet, and also a lot of making sure that the way financial services are being provided are being spread out as many people, as long as you can code solidity, you'll be able to come up with something new, and the rest is decided by the market if they adopt your services or not.
Got it. Awesome. Farhan, would you like to add to that?
I think Joyce covered quite a bit. I mean, I keep it simple in terms of my mental model. There's like four pillars that I kind of think about that kind of differentiates decentralized finance to traditional finance. And, you know, you may have heard of these pillars before, but it's essentially permissionless, i.e. I don't need to ask someone to use a service, trustless, there's no middleman in the way, I can just go use a protocol, decentralized, by using a blockchain. And I think the one that makes me most excited is I feel that it's more equitable, where I can have access to the exact same services that someone else would, and it's not being gated by a bank or an investment bank that's like, hey, look, are you a high net worth individual? Then I will give you a cool product. No, it's like in DeFi, everyone has access to the same set of products, which I think is cool.
Got it. I think you perfectly touched upon the point of equality, right? A lot of services which are provided by Web2, there are biases with respect to what people are offering to whom. And I think DeFi, one point of which it is basically, it's open to everyone. Anyone can participate with their will whenever they want to and whenever they can leave, right? Whenever they want to, right? So I think that gives them freedom and also brings in comfortability and adds a lot of flexibility as well to the overall user journey as well. Awesome. Moving to the next one, and as you guys are closely involved with yields, right? So if you can probably introduce community to, you know, what is yield basically, and how people can generate yield, and if you can talk about, touch upon maybe the DeFi season that was there in 2020, right? And how do you think it will be in a year or two? Right, because we all are talking about DeFi 2.0 now, and how it all will evolve. How do you think it? Like, where do you think this thing is heading? Right, will we be able to see DeFi season 2.0, and where it will be leading towards to? Which all use cases?
I think it's I have to say, this is again, it is a really interesting question, especially for the 2.0 part. Like, different people have so many different interpretations around it. So happy to like go a bit deeper on that. But then in general, I have to say, I think I am less degen than Farhan. So why don't I go first, and then I'll ask Farhan to add on to all the different ways of generating yields that I have probably never tried or never even heard about, because I think he would have the more advanced version for you all. So to begin with, I would say where the yields come from. It's really coming through from, in general, providing services to people and providing incentive for those services to stay alive. So what are those services? The very first one is then for any finance activities to take place, a lot of times we have to trade one asset to another. And that assets could be foreign exchange. You have to trade one, like US dollars to British pounds. And then in doing so, we need certain liquidity in the market that is already available for everyone to buy or sell. You can't just, you know, at the point of trade, you ask someone, hey, you know, you ask everyone in the market to see if they're willing to trade. Instead, you need to build up the liquidity already available in the market for anyone to trade at any point of time. And because of that, I think we see a lot of yields coming through from providing liquidity. And that means if you are willing to set aside your assets for a while, letting them just sit there and allowing other people to use that asset as liquidity to facilitate trading, then you'll be able to earn a return out of it. And that's basically you're getting paid for providing liquidity as a service. And that's why I think a lot of it coming down to anyone trading through that liquidity would effectively pay 0.3% or any other numbers really for the liquidity being there. And that is, I think, what really funds a lot of the DeFi yields we see today. Then aside from that, the other part of why should people put in this liquidity into this types of this pair of assets instead of the other pair of assets, there comes into a competition with lots of governance tokens incentives. So then ideally, if you want USDC, one of the most widely circulated stablecoin, for them to go with, you know, I could always provide liquidity on USDC. But then on the other side, if I forgrow, we have our own stablecoin called Power. It is great. It has a lot of protection for you. It also has come up with its own yield. But then maybe not many people have heard of it yet. So if I want people to provide liquidity on USDC and Power as a pair, then I need to put in a lot more incentives because people haven't heard of it. They don't know it yet, or they don't see what is the point of providing liquidity for this pair. So in that case, we provide growth our governance token as additional incentives just so that people would put their liquidity here instead of some more common pairs like USDC with DAI stablecoin. So I think those are where liquidity comes through. Then the next step we see is typically coming from lending and borrowing activities. And that is, I would say, one step further from just swapping assets, but really having a time element to it, being that any lending and borrowing is really swapping assets, but then when you borrow, you expect them to return it to you in a future time. So that's why it's a time element. And because of that, with the we will be asking for interest just so that it compensates you for the fact you cannot use this asset for a period of time. And I think the interest is definitely a second main part of yield that we generally see in DeFi. I hope that I haven't complicated that too much. But in here, I think let me pause here and maybe pass on to Farhan and see if you'd like to illustrate a bit more on the more complex side of DeFi yields that you have seen in the market.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, like, you know, on our website, we've got this section on, you know, how does DeFi generate income? I feel like you just went through the three sections. But just to summarize for folks, like, there's three key areas. There's trading fees that you get between swaps. There's lending and borrowing on markets that you have, like Aave, for example. And then there's the incentives. The incentives make up a big chunk of yield that you get in DeFi, for example. Everyone's probably familiar with the Curve Wars, and if you're not, take a look at it. But, you know, Curve emissions is a big part of, like, the incentive structure there. I think just to add, there are more exotic ways that you can generate income in DeFi, but this starts going into some more complex strategies. So this could be, you know, options trading, for example, or variations on the things that we've discussed. So we have a Labs product on Avalanche where we work with Alpha Homora, and what we do is we kind of leverage up a position of stablecoins and AVAX and kind of manage this position so people don't get liquidated, but we generate a lot more income on the trading fees than you otherwise would if you just went straight into an AMM like Trader Joe. So yeah, there's different examples like this. But yeah, I won't go into more complex ones. But yeah, I think that's a fair summary, I'd say.
Got it. I think you've fairly added to that question. Now, the question comes down to, we have spoken about DeFi, we have spoken about yields. The important part, I think a lot of these protocols in the DeFi summer itself, which was there before the NFT season, right? We had stable coins being a part of this overall yield infrastructure, where people are generating yields on these stable coins that they own. If you can introduce people over here to stable coins and why they are important for this overall infrastructure, at the very first place, why they are required, right? Why stable coins are required, and then getting into you know, how they're adding value to the overall ecosystem. If you can touch upon those points.
Yeah, sure. So it's an interesting part because we were just having conversations with a wallet provider that shared with us how in the past they were trying to essentially say they're going to charge a fee in the native tokens that they own, they issue. And in retrospect, that felt incredibly weird because, you know, with every token comes a price, and that price could go up or down. It's really hard to foresee where the price would go. And exactly because of this reason, if we are hoping to say, we have to negotiate a deal, and then we're talking about how much you should get paid, and then ideally the payments, you know, would, the value of it would stay the same, regardless of, you know, how long it takes, right, for this business deal to settle. So a stable coin is introduced because we always have confidence that, especially for very major stable coins, there will always be a one-to-one peg to US dollars. And so for any people who are used to trading in US dollars, it will feel quite safe to really say, okay, if I'm getting 100 USDC, I'm going to get $100 of value. Rather than saying that, well, what about if it is a 0.001 ETH, and maybe down the road, it could be a lot more than $100 or a lot less. So I think there is the comfort in knowing that we have a way for us to really trade and really make business deals or just personal arrangements based on a known and certain factor of like how much it is going to be 3 months down the road. And it also, I think, like goes into a second part being, a lot of time we would love to have our own assets in the crypto world to stay there, for the reason that getting it from fiat currencies to on-ram it to the crypto world, or then off-ramming it, it all would take a lot of transaction fees. So ideally, once you put it on, then you can just let it stay. But again, the market goes up or down, and you don't really quite know when it is going to go down, right? So let's say you sell some of your ETH or Ethereum, or let's say some of your Bitcoin, then you get that money. It is great if you can just store it, the value as it is, in stablecoin, instead of say, well, if I have to sell ETH for Bitcoin, that might be when the market crash, they just all crash together. So I think having stablecoin definitely give a lot of mental safety for having your funds parked at the crypto side of the world.
Yeah, I think there's a few things I'd like to add to this. So essentially, it's like you don't want to have crypto assets alone because there's a lot of volatility there. So you want to reduce volatility. And I think I want to kind of extend this whole notion of what we mean by stablecoin as well, because I think a lot of us may just interpret that as a US dollar pegged stablecoin like USDC, USDT, or so on. That doesn't also necessarily need to be the case. I think there's some interesting use cases that come out of stablecoins. So you folks may be familiar with Rai, which is also a stablecoin, but it's using ETH as its underlying to kind of peg itself. It's not a one-to-one with the dollar, for example. I think there's also other interesting use cases coming up as well that I'm excited about with stable assets. So, for example, Frax is coming out with the Frax Price Index. So this is a stable coin that's pegged to inflation, because maybe you guys can relate, but I know once upon a time when banks used to pay interest, the notion was, hey, you can have some money in a bank account because earning interest and it's beating inflation. Unfortunately, inflation's a bit runaway these days, and that's something that we've been looking at more at dealing with. And one way that you can do that is you're generating yield on your stablecoins, yes, or you could take a look at inflation pegged stablecoins, like what FPI is coming out with via Frax. Then there's also the whole notion of, if you want a day-to-day spend crypto assets, you don't want to spend a volatile asset that you don't know what it's going to be worth in an hour's time when you go try to buy a coffee. The question mark on, you know, how many people are actually using crypto assets to buy things day to day. But if you look at countries where inflation is more prone, so let's take the example of Argentina, for example, US dollar pegged stablecoins are super important in economies like that, because that's when you're able to kind of deal with your local currency having going through hyperinflation. You don't have to deal with that, because then if you just have your stable coins that you're going and spending in stores, it's a lot easier to know what you can expect. And yeah, before I get excited with other use cases, there's also UBI and stuff, but yeah, let's not get into that now.
Got it. I think that's pretty fair. And definitely DeFi is expanding into different use cases, and also stable coins. There have been different approaches to it. And in similar approach, one of the approaches basically the ELGO ones, right? So would you like to, probably add something over there? Because those were the part of the overall, basically the DeFi season. And how do you think these are ELGO's stable coins are evolving over the period?
Yeah, sure. I can take this. It's been interesting because I've seen a lot of algorithmic stablecoins come and go. I think the ones that have survived, so I think a good example is Frax with their stablecoin, because essentially it's part collateralized. So you can deposit things like ETH to mint Frax. But at the same time, you have it part algorithmic, where they have their governance token, which is accrued value, which can then help stabilize the system. So if they need to mint more, they can burn their Frax share, etc. And that seems to be a more sustainable model in having algorithmic stable coins. I would still say this is very much experimental. We've had some, black swan style events where the markets have crashed and they've kind of kept peg, which I think is good. I think in time, Lindy effect and these algorithmic stablecoins surviving will kind of be a key indicator of whether they're working or not. Because the most secure ones, of course, you can be like, okay, they're fully collateralized. So you can take something like, let's say USDC, I may not say USD, USDT, question mark on that. But yeah, with USDC, it's one-to-one backed, we can rely on it. So yeah, I think this will be a question that will be answered better in time. A lot have failed, but there are some interesting ones out there that are using a hybrid model that I think, similar to Frax, that would be more likely to be successful.
Got it. Thank you. Joyce, would you like to add to that?
I was just thinking about the hybrid model in a way that, so for example, I mentioned before that Grow has its own stable coin, right? And then fundamentally, this stable coin is actually, it is still coming through deposits of USDC, USDT, and both of them are not necessarily based, they are not based on algorithms, but they are based on back assets. And then similarly, I think DAI, but then except it's more decentralized. And then for us, when we think about the use of stable coins, I think we start with these really main, along the stable coins that have been around for longer, even though they're not based on, they're based on back assets that you need to verify rather than algorithm. I think there were still definitely ways to give people confidence, even though technically then power in itself, it is then have its own way of making sure that it is being backed sufficiently with all of these stable coins. I almost see that there is a way that it is a hybrid in itself as well. But I think that the juggle here for everyone issuing stable coins is, how do you build confidence in your own stable coin when people might not have heard about it, when a lot of people might not know much about the algorithm or don't have the time to go into that in depth to ensure that it's actually safe? And how do you juggle that between, you know, go full in on the algorithm side versus going with the big names where it just inherently carries already a bit more weight and a bit more confidence in it?
Got it. Thank you, Joyce. That leads to me another question, which is basically, I think it has been a part of overall ecosystem, how it's evolving, right? We have seen the DeFi season, then DeFi summer, and then we had NFT season, and then we had layer ones, layer twos, and now things are completely changing because you have different layer twos interacting with each other. There are bridges being built, and there are aggregators like Socket. Right? How do you think the overall DeFi 2.0 looks like with a combination of these cross-chain messaging, right? Like, how do you think people, how these use cases will evolve with the cross-chain element coming in?
I think about this a lot. there's two concepts I kind of want to clarify here. So there's this concept of a multi-chain world where we have lots of different blockchains coexisting. They're not necessarily communicating with one another. Then you have this concept of a cross-chain world where you do have all these blockchains communicating to each other and transferring value. And, you know, this is where the whole concept of bridges comes in. As a DeFi builder that's looking at, we're looking at expanding our offering to be on different chains as well. One of the concerns that we have as builders is, how can we securely ensure that assets don't get lost between different chains if we start bridging them? So, for example, Grover Protocol, we're a yield aggregator. Our job is to take your stable coins and then we go deposit them and use them in different strategies to generate the best income that we can for our customers. Now, if we decide now, we want to send these assets to a different chain, then we have to start thinking about, is this bridge safe that we're using? We don't want a wormhole style situation happening where suddenly, all the assets on one side are lost and the underlying tokens that we have aren't worth anything. So there's a lot of these security concerns that you have to take into account. Right now, there's certain minimal security guarantees you need to think of. So with layer twos, for example, they're deriving their security from Ethereum. So depending on which flavor of layer two you're looking at, so you have your optimistic rollups, they use fraud proofs, they have this week long period where, you know, you can go and say, this transaction isn't legitimate, let's revert it. Or you're using a ZK rollup flavor, bit more instantaneous, not exactly, still can take a couple of minutes. But a bit more secure in terms of the time to verify and finalize things. Now that variation, maybe between those layer twos, you can have those communication happening. So liquidity isn't just on Ethereum. It could be spread against these different layer twos. And yes, you can communicate them with them more securely. But let's say we introduce a different chain now. Let's say we introduce Solana into the mix or Avalanche into the mix. Now, these aren't deriving their security from Ethereum, so you don't have the same security guarantees. So then now you have to trust the bridge. There's different flavors of bridges. Without going into too much detail, you know, there are the three high-level different kinds are you have bridges where you have to trust the bridge provider. You have some form of guardian system where you have a few validators. They all have signed keys there. They can sign transactions. This is similar to what Ronin had going on with their recent hack. This is what Wormhole had going on as well. Whilst these bridges work, you're trusting the custodian of your assets in that bridge for them to be truthful and for them not to get hacked. And there's a lot more security practices that they need to have in place. Then there's the other kind. Maybe you're familiar with Hot Protocol. Now, what Hot Protocol is essentially, it's like liquidity providers on both sides. So you have the native asset, let's say ETH on Arbitrum and ETH on mainnet Ethereum. If you decide to bridge the asset, you get the native asset on the other side. Even though Hop Protocol is doing the communication between the two, there is no intermediary asset, and you get to keep the native asset. So once you've got the asset, you know you're not going to get rugged by the bridge. And then you've got, similar to something what Socket's working on, where you have light clients. Now, this is a bit more difficult to technically implement and requires a lot more integration, but this is probably the most advanced sort of bridge that we could use, and it's the one with the least trust assumptions. Now, those sorts of bridges aren't, you know, fully fledged out there working in a way that us as DeFi builders can utilize right now. I mean, there's some use cases, but it's not there yet. So it's one of those things that we're excited for, that we want to build for, that we hope is coming. But it's with that sort of technology that I would feel more comfortable building, you know, a DeFi protocol that's using users' assets and funds to bridge over between different networks to find the best yield. I wouldn't feel comfortable using current bridge technologies similar to like Wormhole to do that sort of thing, because one, I think it's inefficient, but two, there's a lot more security assumptions you have to make and trust assumptions, and it's just not worth it if you lose users' assets. Sorry, this is a very long-winded answer, but this is something we think about a lot.
Yeah, but I think you've touched upon pretty solid points, right? And I think it's very much required for us to understand as a user, like, what are the risks. But definitely it's an experimental stage that we are in, right? Everything that starts is basically an experiment, right? YAM came up with a concept and it all went in. That was an experiment. And then, you know, now what is happening with the bridges is also, although there's much, much more security required, and there are a lot of chances of these kind of things happening, which had happened with Ron and Wright. So there's huge risk. But having said that, that definitely there are protocols. So for the community, you don't have to worry about things. There are protocols that you can use, which have been there in the DeFi season, and they are still there, and they are constantly building. So, yeah, so that, I think, takes me to the last question from my side, which is more on the idea of DeFi 2.0, right? And we have been hearing this from quite a long time during NFT, you know, after the NFT season also. And then, so it all basically goes to, so basically, every economy will have its own financial systems. And also, top of those financial systems, you will have assets which you can relate to something like NFTs, and you will have a governing body. You can relate to DAOs with that, but eventually it will all be powered by basically financial systems, right, on top of which you are building. So for it to evolve, definitely, I mean, like, although the DeFi season that was there earlier, pretty much people are now much more into NFTs, and there are use cases where people are combining NFTs and DeFi. But yeah, essentially, how do you think the DeFi 2.0 is, you know, gearing up? Or do you think there's still more time for us to see where all these things will evolve? Or do you think DeFi 2.0 is just a hype thing where, you know, we all think that this is going to happen and no one's sure?
I think actually very much to the contrary, that is definitely not the hype. And the reason I say that is, again, coming back to what is like DeFi 2.0, is everyone's have a slightly different interpretation. But I would think of it as, how are we actually creating new use cases, as you very much earlier on asked about, for this space. And a lot of the 2.0's talk comes through when we jump out from, well, what we talked about was very important. Yes, there's a lot of risk for bridging, but then the benefits to cross-chain is also about, we can get so many more people coming into this space, regardless of how much they have in their wallets or how much they are willing to put aside for this space right now. It is, you know, if you can have more different chains that with lower transaction costs, it just widens the access to DeFi for a lot more people. So I think that is important. But the 2.01, I think, is also trying to widen the DeFi users to a different type, meaning that instead of individual users, we are also looking for those who are currently as an equivalent of a company here, which are the DAOs. the decentralized autonomous organizations that are all trying to work together and contribute in building new protocols or new NFT programs, as you said. But then these are all the organizations that could easily amass millions of dollars in USDC, in their own governance tokens, in their treasury. And they would, these people would need to find a way to spend the money, to transfer the money, and to really generate their own yield so that they can grow their own treasury too. And this is where I think is a completely different class of users, that they have very distinct needs. They're sitting on a good pile of money, how to use it wisely, how to really make sure that the day-to-day transfer and operations would go smoothly enough to support the overall growth of Web3. That, to me, is something is so fundamental to the needs that it wouldn't be a hype, but really a problem that seeks for a really wide set of solutions. And that's what we've been seeing for 2.0. Some of the leaders that we have been hearing before are Olympus DAO, where they came up with Olympus Pro to make sure that each of the different DAOs can, or different protocols can, own their own liquidity. So you don't have to rely on third parties to provide them to you because you dole out really high incentives, but instead you are just supplying what you need for your own tokens liquidity. And that is a really potent way, I think, of building the sustainability of this space, especially when, let's say, the hype or the market would come down. But then we would still want to make sure that this space can grow and then being really resilient to any downturn. So that's why I am personally quite bullish about all of these, be it Olympus Pro or Faye and Ondo, they come up with liquidity as a service, Pokemon coming up with their own reactors. All of these are really helping to make sure all the different DAOs and protocols that are building today would be resilient and sustainable for the long run. So this is not going to be a fact, but really rather a very distinct needs that I think we don't see enough solutions yet. And if anyone in this room is actually going to build something for DAOs, I'm sure there will be a lot of great reception for it, because there's just no, I don't think anyone has fully cracked it yet. And so we're all still waiting for a better answer to come.
Because I think Joyce has touched on, so I don't like the, I think the buzzword of DeFi 2.0 is kind of like lost its meaning a little. I mean, essentially, like, the definition that was, I think, the consensus, at least in the Twitter community or other podcasts, has been around what Joyce has described, which is, you know, services for DAOs and that sort of customer. And what excites me more, and I think more to what the intent of your question was, which originally you said, hey, we had this DeFi summer, it was new and exciting, and all these cool protocols came out, and, you know, people made a lot of money. When is something like that going to happen, or in some variation of that, or when is DeFi going to be exciting again? When is the narrative going to switch back to it? Now, I don't know necessarily when the narrative is going to switch back or when it'll be exciting again. I think, thinking about it from first principles, what made the first DeFi summer super exciting was, you know, you had a lot of marketing, and marketing was basically liquidity farming and like these token incentives that were happening, and a lot of these DeFi primitive protocols that were built, like your AMMs, your lending protocols, etc. I think what excites me more in terms of how to get more interest back into DeFi slash also make it an interesting marketplace again is, how do we reach the next 1 billion users? It's not necessary. So DeFi 2.0, the narrative is a lot about treasuries and DAOs, and I think they're an important customer and they have a lot to do in DeFi. But I'm more excited about how do you reach your average person? And I think, you know, going back to the whole premise of why we're having this conversation about making DeFi more accessible, there's a few key things that still need to happen. It's like, you know, how can we have easy wallets where people can access their crypto assets in a way that makes much more sense, as opposed to having this browser extension and a 12-word seed phrase that people need to remember, and thinking about, hey, how do I go through this fiat on-ramp? How do I fund my MetaMask wallet? Now I send this money to like a DeFi protocol. What am I doing? What does this mean? So thinking about, you know, an easier customer user experience, wallets that are super accessible, wink, wink, we're working on one. And then also, how do we make it more accessible where we're not talking about, you know, $50 or $100 transaction fees on Ethereum mainnet, and we have like these L2 chains or alternative L1s where transaction fees are a lot more accessible for people. So it makes sense to transact with $1,000 and not the fact that you need $1 million to make it worthwhile. Yeah.
Awesome. I think I perfectly align over there because I'm a believer that, you know, definitely this space will evolve and grow. And obviously what I'm excited more about is basically how. And I think one part of it is basically the topic itself. How you make it more accessible for a normal Joey, right? So I think that's where I wouldn't say DeFi 2.0, but I think it's more of basically reaching the 1 billion number is something that is something more exciting, right? And if we are able to do it, it's DeFi 2.0, whatever you can call it, but I think that would be the real adoption or real game where, you know, where we will see more people in getting involved with it. And I think Joyce also covered one interesting part of it, which is around DAO toolings, right? And I think they are adding value to the overall. And I think it all circles back to the Legos, right? So DeFi is one important Lego to this overall ecosystem. And definitely it requires to be more accessible, where a normal Joey can simply go into an application and he can simply deposit, withdraw in one click. He can basically earn yields or something like that. That kind of system is required where he doesn't know what goes back into the system. He knows that definitely there's a blockchain involved and there are protocols involved, but at the front, he just has one deposit option, and you know the amount is deposited into his wallet, and it simply goes into that strategy. And it earns yield over the period. I think for a normal Joey to be a part of this ecosystem, that kind of experience is required. Obviously, it will take us some time for us to reach over there. There are a lot of UX problems that needs to be solved. But I think that will drive the next 1 billion adoption. And I'm definitely looking forward to it. And I personally believe in DeFi 2.0, although not the buzzword, but more on the adoption side. I think that's it from my side. Joyce, please go on. Sorry.
Yeah. No. I think that is so well put. It is exactly as you said that how do we make DeFi fundamentally simple to use while maintaining the transparency of what happens behind the scenes? If anyone is interested to learn more, because either way, in the very early stage of DeFi, we are trying to replicate the financial system there is in the traditional sense into the decentralized way. But then what we are losing out really is the accessibility or the simple to use usability of it, meaning that anytime you have to get into this space, I would have to try spending hours learning how things work on different YouTube channels, on different articles, and just try to understand what yield farming is. Like, what is impermanent loss? Like, there are so many of these concepts that maybe they have already existed in traditional finance. But then we never had to really learn about all these because they have, in the traditional finance world, they are all packaged up for us to consume, right? We can try to go back and learn how they work, but it is not necessary. And I think in DeFi, that is what we need to do to make sure that we are going to, yes, there is this whole infrastructure, but then how are we going to make it so easy to use that to get into the deposit stage? You don't have to first do 3 or even 5 hours of research, but as you said, as simple as doing a one-click access and say, okay, I have a wallet, I have this money, I'm going to put that in. If you're curious to know more, it's all very transparent. And I think the transparency is what is going to set us apart from traditional finance, meaning that it's not a black box around how the money goes, how they are generating yield, but rather it's all very transparent. It's on the blockchain. Anyone can access that. And then from the protocol side, we try to visualize that so easily you don't have to dig around the blockchain at all. And the transparency will still be there, but while making sure that we don't lose out to traditional finance on the usability, to making it so simple to use. And I think that's where Grow is really trying to head out to, is to create such products that, again, my siblings, you know, my brothers and sisters, even my mother, I would imagine one day might be able to say, oh, this, I get it. Okay, I put some money in. This is how much return I can be expecting. All right, cool. And in and out, you know, you don't need to spend hours on it. Maybe instead it's just minutes for you to really understand what that is all about. That's the dream, and I think that's what we keep on building towards.
Awesome. I would like to add one fun point over here. I think, and this is from your conversation, and where you're talking about basically the Web2 ecosystem, the current banking system, right? And you said that we don't know if these concepts were already there. I think the current banking system has one concept in common with DeFi, and that is impermanent loss, right? Not technically, but, you know, I mean, like, you have your assets over there where you think that you will earn some interest, but on the other side, the inflation is basically beating you, right? So your assets, that whatever you have compared with inflation, you're losing, right? So I think that one concept is already there in the current system. But
not very sure. I think a lot of the concepts are, again, might already exist, and they are something that we also could very much tangibly point to and to say, wait a second, you know, I thought I got my 5% pay increase, you know, this year, but then if inflation is 7%, then you're really losing money to the system, right? Or even transaction costs. We always talk about gas fee being expensive, but then if we look at cross-border, just like payment system, so many middlemen take away so much money out of this, that if you transfer $100, you might end up only getting $90 or even $80 back on the other side. So I think a lot of that pain is not new. But then I also think that it is still, for this space to win out, we can't just be as good as the traditional finance. We have to be better. And that's why I'm really hoping that we will make sure we get the best of what they offer, being it's already packaged, it's easy to use, but then really marry that to making sure it's winning out on the transparency side and on the ease, well, even like ease to use a much lower transaction cost. So yeah, that's definitely somewhere we all everyone in this space is hoping to make sure it is much better than the traditional finance, that there will be no reason for you not to switch. So eventually decentralized finance just become the default. It's just finance.
Got it. Awesome. Thanks a lot. This was a fantastic session today, and I've personally enjoyed it.